I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Alvin Toffler's best-selling 1970 book, Future Shock, was about how the rate of technological and social change was making people experience something he called information overload. Here's Orson Welles narrating a 1972 documentary based on Toffler's book.
We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are, in fact, the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
Our guest, Douglas Rushkoff, is the author of a new book titled Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He writes about the conflicts between our analog and digital selves and why we often feel overwhelmed and distracted by the sheer amount of information that has become a part of our daily lives. Douglas Rushkoff is an author, teacher, documentarian, and joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, great to be with you.
Well, I don't know if you watched that documentary, that 1972 documentary. It is so quaint. And there are pictures of airplanes landing and all the kind of information overload that people back in the 60s and, I guess, 70s were experiencing. Were you alive then?
Yeah, I was alive then. And it's funny, I was a kid, so I was just hoping to get to land on the moon and have monorails in my town and solar panels and all the things that jetpacks, all that stuff that was supposed to happen. But the thing, it's funny, listening to Orson Welles do that documentary now, it just reminds me of just how narrative that is, how dramatic it is, how 20th century that view of the world is, where we're moving towards this thing and where is it taking us and what's going to happen. You know, it's really, that's what I feel ended when we hit the 20th century or 21st century, that leaning forward into this new scary horizon, you know, and now we're in this present shock is kind of the opposite. It's this, here we are right now. It happened. We've arrived. This is it. You know, the future is so 10 minutes ago. You know, now it's funny just how old that future sounds.
Well, indeed. And do you think, I mean, and obviously we're talking about the end of the 20th century, that it was so much about the turn of the century, the millennium, the Y2K scare. Do you think all of that sort of set people's sights that they were thinking about the future back in the late 20th century? Seems like we're talking about medieval times, but...
I know. I mean, in some sense, we're more in medieval times now, but we'll get to that. But yeah, that almost like we'd been leaning forward to that moment since the Renaissance, you know, since the 1300s and the invention of central currency and interest and growth and manifest destiny and, you know, the human progress and industrialization, you know, that was just going to somehow peak when we hit the year 2000. And some people thought, you know, planes were going to fall from the sky because computers wouldn't know how to calculate four-digit dates. And, you know, I remember KLM grounded their fleet because they were so afraid of that happening. And something really did change, though. When we got to the 21st century, and it was those years. It was the beginning of something else. And people, instead of leaning forward so much and so desperately into the future and speculating and thinking about the growth of the market and the long boom, they started to look at, well, where are we? You know, what's actually happening now? And I think that was a large part of this shift towards presentism.
But do you also think that the attacks of September 11th kind of cemented some of that thinking?
Yeah, it was definitely a discontinuity. You know, it really did feel like, oh my gosh, you know, we in America, certainly, you know, we who have kind of made a career off insulating ourselves from the sort of the effects of what we do around the world, now we're part of it. You know, we can't escape. There's no new frontier. It's like, wow, we're here. And I think it did. It did serve as a break, certainly for a lot of young people. You know, I interviewed lots of people in their 20s, a lot of college kids, you know, and I interact with them a lot anyway. And they really did experience that as a moment of as if their civilization had sort of come to an end and something else needed to begin.
you have a section from the book. I have to laugh because this is I'm a baby boomer, so this is so much a part of my growing up. Before the advent of interactive devices like the remote control, the television viewer would have had to have gotten up from the couch, walked over to the television set, turned off the dial, tuned into a new station, and then adjust the rabbit ears. It's as if you're writing about, you know, horse and buggy, but that wasn't so long ago.
I know, it is funny. I felt like, you know, it was like almost like describing like someone who's reading Melville about how
exactly.
Do they hunt whales or something, and what are these parts called? But you talk about rabbit ears to a kid, and they think it's the ears on a rabbit. They have no
right.
idea, you know, that television used to be this other thing. But, you know, it was such a different thing, and it's not that I'm longing for it or it by any means. You know, it was extremely manipulative, but the relationship that we have to media today, to this, you know, where we can time shift. We decide, you know, oh, we're going to download, you know, House of Cards, you know, with Kevin Spacey on Netflix. And, or, you know, you can't even talk about it the next day because, you know, you're on episode 2, someone else is on episode 7. You're just, everybody's just a walking spoiler. But this way we have of dealing with television, you know, whether it's with our remotes or our DVRs and fast forwarding and DVDs, you watch everything in your own time, in your own way, and you can break down the story. So you don't really, certainly as a storyteller, a big media storyteller, you don't have the same authority and control over your viewer that you used to have.
I remember showing my then grandmother-in-law, who was born in the 19th century, about how a remote control worked, because she was all about getting up and the rabbit ears. And literally, she couldn't comprehend how you could sit in a chair and push a button and a channel would change.
I know, it's interesting. That's sort of the beginning of what I'm calling digiphrenia in this book, which is the sense that you're existing in multiple places at the same time. You know, you've got your Facebook profile and your Twitter feed, and all these things are just kind of operating in parallel to you. You know, and people aren't really used to being parallel processed that way. It's very hard to have multiple identities acting on your behalf when you don't even really know what they're doing. But, you know, that feeling with the remote, I mean, I just had it, you know, in the restroom of a restaurant last night. I went, it's like, do I put my hands, do I wave them, do I have to touch something? And it's like, the soap came out automatically, but the sink, you were supposed to push something to get it to go. And then, I'm like, all right, this is a push something bathroom. And then I go to the towels and they come out automatically on infrared. It's like, the world is just responding to me sometimes in ways that I don't feel directly connected to.
You sound like my grandmother-in-law.
Well, we're all experiencing that all the time. We're all just adjusting to the sort of the interfaces around the things that used to just be stuff.
Because one of the things you say in your book, and I feel this very, very intensely, which is that we are still our analog selves. We still live in many ways in an analog world. Our bodies are analog, but we also have another foot in this digital world. And I think of, you know, the fact that today, if I want to look something up, I can find information about anything. And I so love that, and I so depend on that. But I'm also this analog person.
Right. Yeah. It's that old song. I'm an analog man living in a digital world. And there's a lot of people who are upset about this or think we should go back to analog. And I'm not arguing that. I'm all for digital. It's all great. It's all beautiful. Yay, yay. But we've got to acknowledge that we are still real people. And it seemed to me, and that's why I wrote this book, was that the easiest way for us to sort of understand the difference is in the dimension of time. You know, that analog people live like much more like analog clocks through continuous time. That's our experience of the world, is very continuous, where things are connected to other things. You know, the digital world doesn't really work like that. You know, digital time, if you just think about the way time is on a digital clock, it's just poised. You know, it's 3:23, 3:23, bam, it's 3:24, it's 3:24. That it moves from one thing to another thing to another thing, with each moment being this kind of perpetual, still, you know, almost this frozen presentist moment. And that if you understand sort of how we are these sort of analog people who understand things in terms of goals and progress and movement, that we're moving into this very different media environment where everything is kind of connected to everything else, where your past and your future are just sort of pushed into the present, where we're responding to the kind of incessant pings of our devices, and we're kind of chasing these moments that they offer and forgetting that we're the ones in real time, and all these devices and things are actually the stuff chasing us.
It's interesting you talk that way, because Alvin Toffler said change is nonlinear and can go backwards, forwards, and sideways. I mean, obviously looking into the future, but he's really underscoring what you're saying now.
Right, except now that change is no longer even something that's accelerating. That change is just a state of being. You know, change is the new constant in some sense. So it's not like we feel like we are moving towards a new state of change or a new state of accelerating change. It's like it's all here. The past and the future have kind of collapsed into this one moment, this one sort of mashup moment. I mean, if you think about, you know, what is it like on Facebook when you have your friends from second grade who you forgot about all of a sudden showing up and having, you know, now equal positioning to friends that you made last year or your best friends today. It's like the past no longer creates distance between us and the stuff that happened then, you know, and the future is just upon us. We can't even imagine the future. It's easier for people to imagine, you know, the zombie apocalypse 100, you know, than it is to imagine next week.
You mentioned the pings, and I think we all know exactly what you're talking about, which is you get an alert, you know, that someone is trying to contact you or some information is coming across your smartphone. And to me, it always feels very Skinnerian. And I remember Skinner talking about intermittent reinforcement. That's the hardest behavior to try to stop, because every now and then you get reinforced and then you want more. How do you deal with those pings?
I mean, it's hard, you know, because, right, every, you know, it's most of your email you don't really care about, but, you know, every 20, 30, or 40, one of those pings is like, ooh, something good, a little money, or a new
friend.
Romance, or some, you know, ooh, a friend, you know, there's that little thing, it's like those five, you know, quarters that come out of the slot machine, you know, every hundred pulls, it's like, ah, you know, that
a
dopamine
cat video.
Rush. Exactly. I mean, you know, for me, it has a lot to do with, again, it's kind of recognizing that digital technology lives outside time. You know, it's not happening now. It's happening in a kind of a stalled, bizarre reality where in the early days with digital technology, we used to go on these bulletin boards. You know, there was one called The Well that I participated in. And the thing that was so shocking about digital technology in the late 80s and early 90s is you had all the time in the world to respond to something. You know, you would download a conversation through your modem. You'd sign off the internet, you'd read the whole conversation, and you would think maybe for an hour or even overnight how you were going to respond, and you would create this perfect paragraph and then upload it into the conversation. And the internet was a place that, because of the way it broke up time, the internet was a place where you were smarter and you sounded smarter than you were in real life. And now, for people to imagine the internet as a place where they could be smarter than they were in real life is unimaginable, and that's because they're attaching it to their arms and having it vibrate them and compel them to respond right now, rather than giving them that much more kind of healthy, disjointed relationship to digital participation.
And we have to take a very short break right now. That's Douglas Rushkoff, our guest, author of Present Shock. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. No composer ever expressed such aching sorrow, ever captured the agony of the crucifixion as did Johann Sebastian Bach. Yannick Nezet-Séguin, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and choruses perform Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Tickets at 215-893-1999. Online at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach.
This week in This American Life, millions of people have been removed from welfare rolls in the last 15 years. Politicians have patted themselves on the backs for that. But at the very same time, the same number of people have signed up for government disability checks. It's ballooned from 8 million to 14 million people. Not all the same people who came off welfare, but there are towns where it is 1 in 4 adults. 1 in 4. This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Writer Taye Selassie's own life shows the bright side of immigrant success, but in her debut novel, she reveals some of the dark side that she says too often stays hidden.
As a novelist, I ask of myself only that I tell the truth and that I tell it beautifully.
Taye Selassie tells us about her debut novel, Ghana Must Go. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's a media theorist. He's written a dozen books. He's a CNN commentator. He's made several PBS documentaries. He teaches at NYU and the New School, and he's got a new book called Present Shock, Why Everything Happens Now, where he says that our analog selves have come in conflict with our digital desires, and that has led to anxiety and overload. If you can relate to what we're talking about, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Doug, you mentioned digiphrenia, and you have chapter titles, Digiphrenia, Fractal Noia, Apocalypto. I want to get to all of that, but spell out or flesh out digiphrenia for us.
Well, digiphrenia is really just the mental confusion that results from having more than one, concurrent identity functioning at the same time. You know, it's really just this kind of state of mental confusion that comes from using digital technology to try to copy yourself rather than to copy data. You know, we tend to ape the dominating technologies of our time. So, you know, in the industrial age and the clockwork era, we called it, we thought of people like clocks, like machines with a ticker in the heart. And, you know, and now we think of people like computers, that we have hard drives and all that. But we don't. we're people. So digiphrenia really comes from trying to kind of parallel process as a person rather than really acknowledge that human beings live in a very different kind of time.
Well, I'm picking up on that, and I keep going back to my family, but that's the experiment that I'm running. And I find myself, you know, navigating between these worlds and feeling some of that digiphrenia. But I see with my son, who's in his 30s, this is the world that he grew up in. He seems so much more comfortable and conversant in this world, in both the analog and the digital world. And I don't know whether what we're talking about is a generational issue, and I think you're somewhere in between the two of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's generational to a certain extent, but there are a lot of kids who are way more comfortable in the digital realm than they are in the real one. You know, they've adapted to digital time, but they haven't really necessarily brought analog time along with them. So you find it's hard for young people to make eye contact. It's hard for them to carry on an extended conversation or make an extended argument about something. And I'm not—I'm the last one to condemn kids and how they've adapted and what they're doing. But what I'm trying to do is to help them and all of us kind of reconnect to some of the other ways of experiencing life and time. You know, there's sort of a difference, and it's an age-old battle, if you will, between, you know, what the Greeks called chronos and kairos, or clock time and timing. You know, time is the thing on the clock. It's 3:22. Timing is something very different. It's like, you know, what's the best time to tell Dad you crashed the car, right? It's not 3:02 or 3:03, right? It's after he's had his drink, but before he's opened the bills. You know, that's timing. And I want people to begin to remember, especially in a digital age where we're no longer beholden to the clock, where we can do things in our own time, where we can program our own reality, that human beings are living in a very very specific timescape that's not just generic. You know, it does matter whether it's light or dark. It does matter what phase of the moon you're in, what season you're in. You know, all of this stuff we've been reacting to as biological organisms for hundreds of thousands of years, and we can't just, you know, erase them with a Google Calendar.
One of the things that you write in your book, whatever is vibrating on the iPhone just isn't as valuable as the eye contact you are making right now.
Right. I mean, because to a certain extent, once someone has relegated something to that digital space, it's no longer in real time. It's in a sequence. It's part of a program. And who knows? I mean, gosh, you know, I can't download a news app without having it. I got to go into the preferences of my iPhone someday and change everything again. You know, they're just throwing news alerts at you as if they matter. You know, I don't care. You know, you've come up with some new reason why the stock market changed, or, I mean, please, you know, we're not living in a newsroom. You know, if someone's assassinated, I'll find out, you know. So there's a certain point at which you can't live as if, you know, well, this is, again, revealing my age. You can't live as if the operator needs to be able to cut in at any moment because a grandparent needs to be taken to the hospital. I mean, those are not typical daily events. Those are things that happen once every 5 or 10 years. Yet we're vibrating on ourselves and alerting ourselves and breaking into our conversations, breaking into our time with these things that really do mimic emergencies, and they're not.
Well, and I'm also, as you're describing that, I'm also thinking it's almost become a cliche now about the use of Twitter and the Arab Spring. I mean, there are times when that information is vital and fascinating and important.
And you dip into it when it is. So there's something happening that you want to be attuned to. Usually you'll find out from a person or from television, you're, oh my gosh, there's a revolution happening in a country I care about. So now I'm going to turn on Twitter and be part of that feed. Now I'm going to dip in to that hurricane of information and parsing it and feel part of that thing. But that's not the normal way of moving through time. That's not the way we live the majority of our lives. You know, you can go into an always-on state. You know, 9/11 happens, and you're going to go volunteer, and you're going to be there. Or you're part of Occupy, and the Occupy, it's really happening now, and there's a major event. So you turn it on, and you're there, you're part of it. But, you know, if you live in that always-on state, you know, at real-time availability to every ping, I mean, in the end, that's living more like an air traffic controller or an ambulance driver than it is a regular person.
Because everything is competing for our attention, and everything says, I'm as important as everything else.
Right. There's that sort of Darwinian mimetic battle happening out there. And it's fine that it happens, but it's very hard to stay in touch with the what's happening inside you. It's hard to make eye contact with another person, to develop rapport over the table if you're both looking at your at the feed that's coming in, however important that feed may seem to be.
Let me ask you about something you wrote about. I'm looking at it in CNN, why you left or are leaving Facebook. Why are you, or why did you leave Facebook?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's related to this notion of digiphrenia, which is, you know, where you have multiple identities doing stuff on your behalf that you can't completely control. You know, the reason I left Facebook is because I no longer have authority over what I do on Facebook. In other words, Mark Zuckerberg or whoever's running Facebook can use my image in an advertisement for something that I may or may not like, you know, and worse, they can take anyone who's liked my page, anyone who's decided they've liked my books, they can also be used to advertise something that I may have liked or something that may have liked me, you know, and when an organization like Facebook is sort of modifying and evolving its user agreement to give itself more and more control over how my identity is used, then I either have to surrender it and say, okay, they have authority over me and I don't, or I have to cut bait and say, look, this is just not worth it. And also by doing it, I was trying to show people that, look, Facebook is not the internet. Facebook is not the only way to connect with other people and to have an identity on there. And if you feel, as I happen to, if you feel that they're abusing that privilege, then you're perfectly fine to move on and the world will not end.
Do you miss it at all? Or what have you substituted in its place?
life. I mean, time, friendship. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I do get a little bit more email now than I did before from people who can't send me those little poke messages. But, you know, I didn't see those poke messages before anyway because the interface is so convoluted on Facebook. I'm much more comfortable with, you want to talk to me, send me a message. It doesn't have to be in public, right? You can actually engage with me privately without announcing something. You know, it's just the whole notion of living in public is fine, but it shouldn't be mandatory. And, you know, and it feels like, you know, I think about a kid, you know, when I grew up back in the old days, you know, we'd go to the mall and you'd buy posters and records and things and you'd put them up on the wall of your bedroom and a kid might come in and see it and go, oh, you know, that Farrah Fawcett poster's not cool anymore, you know, or whatever. Now, a kid decorates, they don't decorate the wall of their bedroom, they decorate a wall of promotion. You know, they are broadcasting each of those things to the entire world indelibly forever. And that's a very, it's a tricky way to grow up because you're no longer experimenting, you're performing. And it's hard to perform for the whole world when you're just emerging, 11, mm-hmm. 12, 13, 14 years old, you know, you should be able to experiment in a way. I mean,
everyone gets to comment on your worldwide performance too.
Right. And it's just, it's a different thing. You don't have that practice space anymore. You know, they're performing in the same space that the people on reality TV are performing, that I'm performing, that we're all performing.
And that's Douglas Rushkoff, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Present Shock, and it's subtitled When Everything Happens Now. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Joni to join us. Joni from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. And Joni, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wanted to just make a comment about the rabbit ears. I don't watch a lot of TV, and all the TV I watch is basically online, legally. So I actually have a digital antenna on my TV, and sometimes I do have to adjust it. And it's free. I pay for the antenna, and
there
it's free.
There you go.
And the other comment I wanted to make was to simplify the noise in my life and free up some of my time. I actually deleted the Facebook app on my smartphone, and I feel so liberated.
Well, it sounds
having
like
I've done that.
Well, Douglas sounds like a kindred spirit there to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the only way out is through. In other words, in order to be able to do what she did, you've got to know more about this stuff, not less, right? So it's not a matter of trying to shut it out and close it down and go away. It's a matter of understanding, oh, this is my phone. I can configure it. And if it's not letting me configure it, then I need a different phone that's going to let me configure it. In other words, you don't have to accept all this stuff at face value. You don't have to use it the way they're telling you to use it. You can use it the way that it actually makes sense for you.
Joni, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Doug, you also talk about something, the collapse of the narrative or narrative collapse. That's one of your chapter titles in this book. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I guess it's the idea that, I mean, and I guess it'll help make it clear that, you know, not everything in this book is about the digital. There's really one chapter about how the digital plays into this, what it's like to live in a digital environment. You know, narrative collapse is really about what is it like to live in a world where if you are in the present tense, if everything is happening now, then how do you structure goals? Where do you come from and where are you going? You know, so narrative collapse, on the one hand, yeah, it's things like the remote control and TiVo and all that let you break up television so you don't really fall into the spell of the traditional storyteller. But it's also about, you know, what do we do if we don't have long-term goals? How do you make political movements? How do you motivate people if, you know, you're not going to end? If you're not going to declare, oh, we're going to get to the moon in 7 years and stick a flag on the surface and we did it. If you no longer have those goals and endpoints, how do people work? You know, how do people move towards things? How do people make the world a better place? You know, and that's where I start looking at, you know, the metaphor of games or the Occupy movement, things like that, where people are, rather than being like a political campaign, going towards a great ends justify the means goal, you know, keeping your eyes on the prize and winning the day. How do you sort of live that in the present? You know, and it's confounding to people, right? The news media went to Occupy and said, what do you want? What are your demands? What are your goals? And they wouldn't state them in those sort of old-fashioned narrative, goal-oriented terms. They would keep saying, you know, we're doing it right now. This is it. We are occupying. You know, when is this going to end? And they would say, well, it doesn't end. This is a steady state. Mm-hmm. It's a way of doing things. And that's really much more consonant with the kind of the digital game-playing, open-ended, almost fantasy role-playing approach to life, where we're playing the game to keep the game going. We're not playing the game in order to win, which is only going to end the play.
Well, maybe I'm being too concrete here, but as I was reading your chapter on this, it sounds like you were criticizing the way narratives are written or perhaps even lived today, the idea that we don't have these linear stories. But I was thinking about, frankly, how much good stuff is on television these days with incredible stories and narratives. I'm thinking of The Wire, The Sopranos. I mean, it's a long list.
Right.
Thinking about, you know, kids standing in line for hours on end to buy the newest Harry Potter book and then sitting down and absorbing that. So it seems like narrative, maybe you and I are using different language here, but and even the love of memoirs these days.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
so much interest in narrative.
Narrative is alive and well, but, you know, if you do look at shows like The Sopranos, what was the end of The Sopranos?
Right.
There was no end.
Sitting in the restaurant, right.
Sitting in a restaurant and suddenly stopped, as if to say, there is no climax, or we're not going to give you the climax. There is no kabang, and if there is a kabang, he's not going to know it, because he's just going to be dead.
His back
and
is
the
turned.
Same for all of you. You know, when it's over, it's over. I mean, Game of Thrones is this never-ending story. So I'm not saying there's no story, there's no continuity. There is. There's, in some sense, it requires more patience. It's these kind of meta-narratives, these stories without end, these sort of almost participatory, ongoing, 5-volume, 10-volume sagas that move on much more almost, in some sense, episodically, almost like a Dickens, one of those Dickens serialized novels. They continue, and you're not really watching these things for the gangbusters' conclusion. You're watching them because you like to immerse in these worlds and kind of imagine yourself with these people. I mean, I don't want Game of Thrones to end.
Right.
I want it to keep ongoing. It's more like a soap opera, really, than it is a traditional movie.
But that's okay, right? I mean, you're not necessarily criticizing that. I guess what it is that we are experiencing this ongoing narrative in its present form.
It is okay. What it denies us is that sort of reversal and recognition that you get from Aristotle, right? Or from an ancient Greek drama. You know, you don't get that climax and relief, which in some ways is a great thing. I mean, Western culture has been stuck on the, you know, crisis, climax, sleep model of narrative for a couple of thousand years. And it's been used to, you know, to create movements that really keep people so focused on what they're going to get that they don't look at what they're doing, right? It motivates wars and all sorts of things. At the same time, we have to then begin to look at how do we create a sense of history when it's all just coming at once? How do we have a connection to the past? How do we envision the future without kind of going off the rails?
And that's Douglas Rushkoff, our guest today in Radio Times. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation. His new book is called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. We've got almost a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents the 31st Annual Chester County Antiques Show, Friday, April 5th through Sunday, April 7th at the Phelps School in Malvern, PA. More than 50 exhibitors feature 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, paintings, glass, silver, jewelry, needlework, and other decorative arts. Presented by PICO. For details on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or ChesterCoHistorical.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Hayes, the former host of the MSNBC morning show Up, talks with us about moving from weekends to weeknights with his new show, how he learned to deal with conflict on TV, and how he approaches the discussions he moderates.
Simmer, not boil, which is our ideal space for a conversation.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Supreme Court considers its second same-sex marriage case a challenge to the part of the federal law that denies benefits to same-sex couples. Also, Domenico Ruta's wrenching new memoir about growing up with a charismatic but drug-abusing mom. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Douglas Rushkoff about his new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. These are the chapter titles, Narrative Collapse, Digiphrenia or Digiphrenia, Overwinding, Fractalnoia, and Apocalypto. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Doug, just a quick follow-up to this whole narrative thing that we were talking about before the break. You also say that computer games are pop culture's first satisfactory answer to the collapse of the narrative. Expand on that, and I do want to get back to our callers.
Well, I mean, in traditional media, as we know it, you know, you generally watch a character go through a situation, right? He makes a series of choices, and the good or bad thing happens to them, right? So a story that you read or a movie that you watch is a story that's basically already happened and now it's being told to you. A video game happens in the now. It's you are the character and you are making the series of choices that are bringing you from one place to another. So it's kind of a real-time experience. And it's also an experience in the best of games, you know, like, say, World of Warcraft or these giant, massively connected games, where you're not playing to finish. You're not playing to get done. You know, you're not living to die, right? But you're living to live. You're playing in order to keep the game going, which to me is much more consonant with a world whose problems have to do much more with sustainability than winning something. You know, I think we're finally old enough to realize, we can't just destroy this place. We have to actually figure out a long-term strategy. And in some ways, teaching ourselves through entertainments that aren't about victory and termination, but are about keeping things going is a better model. I think it's a better approach towards a sustainable life.
And playing largely with strangers or people you have never met.
Which is interesting. And I would think, I guess you go to a movie, you know, and you sit there with people you've never met, but here you're actually, you know, turning to them and hopefully making some friends. Getting some remedial help for all of the alienation and disconnection we've had through broadcast media.
There you go. It's always the broadcast media's fault. Let me get Veronica to join us. No, that's okay. We're a big target. Let me get Veronica to join us. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, boy. I think I need to get this book.
Okay, good.
I found myself riding a wave of high anxiety last night while I was attempting to, well, among other things, read on my new Nook, and by the way, I'll be 72 on Tuesday.
Okay.
And I resisted e-readers for a long time, but I finally caved because rushing back and forth to the bookstore in this kind of weather we've had this winter was just too much time taken. So I was reading the Nook, but I was reading or rereading Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. So there I was in the late 18th, early 19th century, and suddenly it occurred to me that I wanted to find out what had gone on at the Supreme Court, and it was 9 o'clock, and Rachel Maddow was on, and she'd probably be the best person to tell me what happened. But I had my Nook in my hand, and I had Rachel on, and I was just about getting used to how to operate the Nook completely, and I found myself so anxious that I suddenly said, "This is ridiculous. You turn off one thing, you turn off the other. You can't I have children in their 30s and early 40s who could probably have done managed both
sure.
and other things besides.
Well, Veronica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm sure others have found themselves in similar situations. Doug, can you relate to Veronica's story?
Oh, yeah. And the fact of the matter is, with every experiment we've done so far, I mean, you could look at, you know, Cliff Nass's work at Stanford as sort of the most advanced in this realm. Even people in their 20s who believe that they are great multitaskers, these are Stanford students, that's as smart as people get, and they think they're multitasking and being tremendously efficient and effective, even they are much, much less effective, much less accurate when they're trying to multitask than when they're doing one thing at a time. It's just the way human attention works. You know, so, and it's funny, you know, you say, I thought of this when you say you're 72, you know, and I'm 52. And, you know, someone said to me the other day, you look really young for 52. And I'm like, well, no, this is 52. This is it. You know, there's this kind of an ageism, I guess, that I feel like we are at the moment when ageism is really going to be addressed on the same level as, like, you know, racism and sexism. Because ageism is really an artifact, again, of the sort of old-fashioned sort of industrial age narrative model of a person's life. Now they're young, now they're effective, mm-hmm. now they're old, and then they retire. You know, and it's like, no, we're all alive and all thinking all the time. You know, so no, the fact that you're 72 doesn't make you less or more digital than someone who's 22. You know, we are still, you know, there's a whole lot more human history behind what makes us the same than behind what makes us different.
Veronica, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Doug, do you think we're all then the same age online?
In some sense, I do. You know, I think it has a lot more to do with whether you can think critically about the spaces that you're entering, how much you understand about how this world has been programmed, how capable you are of sensing the biases. You know, when you go to a website or you go to an application, what does it want from you? You know, I think there's people of all ages who think that Facebook is there to help them make friends. And there's people of all ages who also know that Facebook's not there to help them make friends. It's there to monetize their social graph. You know, and that's, I don't think that's age dependent, except in the sense that if you were raised in a world where Facebook was a given condition, where it was just there all the time, where probably we're more likely to accept it on face value than we are to question what it's there for.
Let me see what Brett from Philadelphia has to say. Brett, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, that's a great point that you just made about Facebook and people who have grown up with it as opposed to you know, people who came into their lives. But my question has to do with an article that was in the New York Times a few weeks ago about how 20-somethings are almost required to be in front of their email for certain jobs, and I'm curious as to what you think the implications are of that, you know, down the line for the workforce, and you know, if there's mm-hmm. going to be a negative effect in terms of people's workflow and how they get things done, because you know they're always required to be in front of their email.
Brett, are you one of those 20-somethings required to be in front of your email?
Possibly.
Fair enough. Go ahead, yeah. Doug. Thanks, Brett.
I mean, it may sound like a lofty answer, but it's the real reason I wrote the whole book to begin with. You know, I feel like digital technology gave us the opportunity to do things in our own time. You know, the original dream of the internet is, you know, now I can work at home, in my underwear, in my own time, you know, rather than having a 9-to-5 industrial age job. You know, we invented the clock in 11, 12, 1300, depending on which clock you're looking at. And we implemented the industrial age. We created the time is money sort of wage labor by the hour culture that we live in. The digital technology gave us a way out of that, where we wouldn't have to work by the clock anymore. And instead, what we've done, at least so far, is we've extended the ethos of the industrial age. The time is money, maximize efficiency, you know, keep people working on shifts and all that, which is so bad for your body and your mind. We know what happens. The people who are working shift labor get more cancer and have higher rates of anxiety and PTSD and all the kind of stuff that we don't want to have. The more we can take back our time and start working in ways that are consonant with our sort of analog bodies, rather than being like We're kind of, it sounds like the caller was kind of turned into a postal worker, sort of that kind of thing, where you're just looking at zip codes and having to keep on being on and be available and ping, ping, ping. That's not the way humans work. It'd be so much better. He'd be so much more efficient if the boss even said, look, every 2 hours you've got to go and you've got to look at this. Or you're going to be on call for 2 hours every day. You're the guy that has to be ready to answer an email in a moment. And when you get that, and then you get a break after that, and you get to calm down or have a cheese sandwich or something, you know, but we don't look at it that way. We try to make our workers as sort of generically always on in real time as a computer terminal, and that's not the way we function best.
Brett, thanks for the call to Radio Times, because I think as wonderful as access to this technology is, then it's so easy to work then all the time. It's not the shift work. It's the endless, relentless work.
Right. I mean, I think of it in terms of radio. It's like you do your 2 hours a day. Your show's 2 hours, right?
Yes, it is.
I mean, you do your 2 hours and you are on. I mean, and your hormones are going and your steroids and all this stuff is in you. You know, your body's doing
that. You should see me.
I know. But and then you do, every once in a while, you do, you know, the marathon for fundraising. And then you're on maybe 8 hours. And you could do that once or twice a year. You can do that Jerry Lewis-style telethon marathon thing. But you can't live like that. You know, you can't. You just get fried.
Oh, goodness gracious. I'm going to let that just lie out there. Let me see what Dan from Trenton has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I love the subject matter. I have this conversation with my nieces and nephews all the time, especially at the dinner table when they pull out the digital media. Mm. And I ask them, you know, do you want to be here with us in an analog way, or just want to just go be with the people you're on with digitally? And this conversation reminds me of something I read from Guy Kawasaki, the Apple guy.
Yeah.
Digital power was designed to make us better analog people. And the examples you talked about, the Arab Spring and Occupy, I mean, those were as much digital revolutions, but they organized people to react, to act, and interact in a very physical way. And that goes right to the point of your guest and, I think, Guy Kawasaki's comments. So that's what I wanted to comment on.
Well, thanks, Dan. I appreciate that. And Doug, digital power designed to make us better analog people. Agree?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the board of a company called Meetup, right? That Meetup was basically looking at, well, look, why don't we use the net instead of using the net to have these online conversations? What if we use online conversations to have people meet up, you know, in real life and actually get together? It's interesting. You look at Arab Spring. I mean, when the activity on the streets really got going was when the Egyptian government tried to turn off the internet. And all of a sudden everybody goes, well, I can't do this revolution from home anymore. I'm going to have to go outside. I mean, I know that's oversimplifying it, but it is interesting that, you know, we can use this stuff to organize our real life rather than retreat from our real life. So, you know, on the one hand, these technologies can create this kind of Huffington Post-like echo chamber of opinions where we don't actually do anything in the real world. But on the other hand, I feel like we're evolving past that now, and people understand that this is the way we can get informed, way we can model behaviors that we then take extremely locally. I mean, and that's been the political effect of the net so far, is really localism. These movements are not these big international broadcast-style things which are important to the one on the one hand, that's the way you do a presidential campaign, but it's not the way you get people to do community supported agriculture or local currencies or getting meals to old people and things like that. That's what happens, you know, in flesh and blood reality.
Let's get Mary from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, and thank you very much for the show.
You're very welcome.
I just feel that I love the net. I love all that's going on. And I'm a pretty progressive grandmother. I am also going to be 72.
There you go.
I have a one-month-old granddaughter that I have not seen a picture yet because she's on Facebook and I'm not. I have a daughter that's in the Army. My neighbor said they saw her in full uniform. I didn't. This is just exacerbating the generation gap. Well, I feel so shut off from my grandchildren.
Well, let me ask you, Mary, is that a reason for you to figure out how to get online? Do you want to do that?
Well, my son is a IS administrator.
Uh-huh.
And I am online. I have 3 emails. I did a lot of work teaching at Temple. But he told me not to go on Facebook for security reasons.
Well,
but my children used to email me with an attachment, and I could print it up.
Right. Well, you know what, Mary? Let me see what I don't know if Doug can solve your problem or not. But you know, here's a bit of a disconnect.
I mean, it is kind of a shame. I mean, because on the one hand, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the reason to avoid Facebook for me, it maybe is a little bit more political than it is, you know, personal. I mean, I don't think it's so dangerous. You know, it's more, you know, there's companies that are going to know all sorts of things about you, but it's not like, you know, someone's going to, you know, attack you or hurt you somehow. On the other hand, your family who are on there really should be able to send you an attachment. They should be able to engage with you. You know, it's what they're saying by doing things on Facebook is that they want to relate to everybody generically the same way. Here's the picture. Here's this. Here's that. They're not giving it to you. You know, they're giving it to the circle, to the thing. And you know, I do think it's okay as someone's parent or grandparent to be like, no, you know, I want personal communication. I want you to call me. I want you to write to me, you know, that's not a terrible or unrealistic demand to make.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Doug, we're almost out of time here, but you do mention The Real Housewives in your book. Do you watch the show? Are you a regular watcher?
I don't know. You know, I get them all confused because there's all these different ones, it turns out. I thought they were the same people. It's a funny thing. I was watching Real Housewives of Orange County and Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I didn't realize it was 2 different shows. That's how good I am at it.
That's how good the plastic surgery is, don't you think?
Exactly. Which is sort of the whole point, that these women are trying to lock in time at age 29, and it's made their faces utterly unavailable to the moment that they're really in.
Well, on that note, Douglas Rushkoff, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. The book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can get information about programs past and present. You can have access to our archives. You can follow us on Twitter, and yes, check us out on Facebook. You can get information about downloading podcasts, how to be a caller, and how to find us on Sirius Satellite Radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Bryant helping us out today. Also, Heather Bromfield, our intern. Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.